This podcast is brought to you by Lannan Foundation, available at podcast.lannan.org. Chris Hedges with Amy Goodman, recorded in Santa Fe on March 1st, 2006. Chris Hedges, a veteran war correspondent now at the New York Times, has survived ambushes in Central America, imprisonment in the Sudan, and a beating by Saudi military police. In this podcast, Chris Hedges joins in conversation with Amy Goodman, host of the daily radio program, Democracy Now!
Thank you all very much for coming out tonight. Thank you to the Lannan Foundation for sponsoring this evening, and a very special thank you to Chris Hedges for coming here to share his experiences with us tonight. Chris Hedges is a foreign correspondent, or was one, for more than 15 years. He was reporting for the New York Times, before that the Dallas Morning News, National Public Radio, the Christian Science Monitor. He, in the process of all this, also had gotten his Master of Divinity from Harvard University. He has written three books: War is a Force That Gives Us Meaning, which will be the topic of his speech tonight; What Every Person Should Know About War; and his latest book is Losing Moses on the Freeway, The Ten Commandments in America. Chris talks about how he has spent his adult life covering El Salvador, Guatemala, Nicaragua in the 1980s, Colombia as well, the first and second intifadas, Gaza, the civil war in Sudan and Yemen, the uprisings in Algeria and the Punjab, the fall of the Romanian dictator, the Gulf War, the Kurdish rebellion in southeast Turkey and northern Iraq, the war in Bosnia, Kosovo, and following Al-Qaeda after 9/11. And as Chris writes, I have been in ambushes on desolate stretches of Central American roads, shot at in the marshes of southern Iraq, imprisoned in the Sudan, beaten by Saudi military police, deported from Libya and Iran, captured and held for a week by the Iraqi Republican Guard during the Shia rebellion following the Gulf War, strafed by Russian MiG-21s in Bosnia, fired upon by Serb snipers, and chilled for days in Sarajevo with deafening rounds of heavy artillery. Tonight, we'll find out why he kept and why he kept on going back. Christopher Hedges.
Thank you, Amy. One of America's last journalists, I'm afraid. The vanquished know war. They see through the empty jingoism of those who use the abstract words of glory, honor, and patriotism to mask the cries of the wounded, the senseless killing, war profiteering, and chest-pounding grief. They know the lies the victors often do not acknowledge, the lies covered up in stately war memorials and mythic war narratives, filled with stories of courage and comradeship. They know the lies that permeate the thick, self-important memoirs by amoral statesmen who make wars but do not know war. The vanquished know the essence of war, death. They see that war is a state of almost pure sin with its goals of hatred and destruction. They know how war fosters alienation, leads inevitably to nihilism, and is a turning away from the sanctity and preservation of life. All other narratives about war too easily fall prey to the allure and seductiveness of violence, as well as the attraction of the godlike power that comes with the license to kill with impunity. But the words of the vanquished come later, sometimes long after the war, when grown men and women unpack the suffering they endured as children, what it was like to see their mother or father killed or taken away, or what it was like to lose their homes, their community, their security, and be discarded as human refuse. But by then, few listen. The truth about war comes out, but usually too late. And we are assured by the war makers that these stories have no bearing on the glorious, violent enterprise the nation is about to inaugurate. And lapping up the myth of war and its sense of empowerment, we prefer not to look. The current coverage of the war in Iraq does not expose the pathology of war. We see the war from the perspective of the troops who fight the war, or the equally skewed perspective of the foreign reporters holed up in hotels, hemmed in by drivers and translators and bodyguards and official minders. There are moments when war's face appears to these voyeurs and professional killers, perhaps from the back seat of a car where a small child, her brains oozing out of her head, lies dying. But mostly it remains hidden. And all our knowledge of the war in Iraq has to be viewed as lacking the sweep and depth that will come one day, perhaps years from now, when a small Iraqi boy or girl reaches adulthood and unfolds for us the sad and tragic story of the invasion and bloody occupation of their nation. War for now is presented primarily through this distorted prism of the occupiers, the embedded reporters dependent on the military for food and transportation as well as security, have a natural and understandable tendency, one I have felt myself, to protect those who are protecting them. They are not allowed to report outside of the unit and are, in effect, captives. They have no relationships with the victims, essential to all balanced reporting of conflicts, but only with the Marines and soldiers who drive through desolate, mud-walled towns and pump grenades and machine gun bullets into houses, leaving scores of nameless dead and wounded in their wake. They feel protected as well by the jet fighters and heavy artillery and throaty rattle of machine guns. And the reporting, even among those who struggle to keep some distance, usually descends into shameful cheerleading. Those who cover war also dine out on the myth about war and the myth about themselves as war correspondents. Yes, they say it is horrible and dirty and ugly, but for many of them, it is also glamorous and exciting and empowering. They look out from the windows of Humvees for a few seconds at Iraqi families cowering in fear and only rarely see the effects of the firepower. When they are forced to examine what bullets, grenades, and shells do to human bodies, they turn away in disgust or resort to black humor to dehumanize the corpses. They cannot stay long in any event, since they must leave the depressing scene behind for the next mission. The tragedy is replaced, as it is for us at home who glimpse it on television screens, by a light moment or another story. It becomes easier to forget that another human life has been ruined beyond repair, that what is unfolding is not only tragic for tens of thousands of Iraqis, but for the United States as well. And as the war sours, as it no longer fits into the mythical narratives of us as liberators and victors, it fades from view. The very cable news shows that packaged and sold us the war as a heroic battle for freedom and liberation now prefer the soap opera sagas of Brad and Jen or Michael Jackson to the carnage gripping the streets of Baghdad. Average monthly coverage of the war in Iraq on ABC, NBC, and CBS newscasts combined has been cut in half, falling from 388 minutes in 2003 to 274 in 2004 to 166 in 2005. And major newspapers, such as the Boston Globe, are shutting down their bureaus. War, when we see it, is presented as a game, as entertainment, and commentators on the cable news channels revel in the power and might of our own weaponry and, by extension, our own power. We watch neatly packaged video clips fed to the press by the war makers, and we are spared the pools of blood, the agony of the dying on the other end. It is clean and neat and tidy and wildly out of context. There is the technological capacity to show us war. We could watch live footage of a young Iraqi soldier with his legs blown off by an anti-tank mine dying in the sand, something I saw in the Persian Gulf War. But such coverage would hardly boost ratings, hardly make us want to wage war. And so we are fed the myth the press almost always feeds us in wartime and kept from seeing. And when the myth cannot be sustained, when the lie is palpable, the war is shunted to the sidelines, its daily brutality replaced by trivia and gossip. There is no more candor in Iraq or Afghanistan than there was in Vietnam. But in the age of live satellite feeds, the military has perfected the appearance of candor. For the myth of war, the myth of glory and honor, sells newspapers and boosts ratings. Real war reporting does not. Nearly every embedded war correspondent sees his or her mission as sustaining civilian and army morale. The identification of reporters with the units they cover is insipid and dangerous, but also usual. In war, the press is always part of the problem. In wartime, as Senator Hiram Johnson reminded us in 1917, truth is the first casualty. We have blundered into nations we know little about, caught between bitter rivalries between competing ethnic and religious groups. We have embarked on an occupation in Iraq that is as damaging to our souls as it is to our prestige and power and security. We have become tyrants to others weaker than ourselves, and we believe falsely that because we have the capacity to wage war, we have the right to wage war. Once you master a people by force, you depend on force for control. Isolation always impairs judgment, and we are very isolated now. In Antigone, the king imposes his will without listening to those he rules and dooms himself. Thucydides wrote of how Athens' expanding empire led it to become a tyrant abroad and then a tyrant at home. The tyranny Athens imposed on others, it finally imposed on itself. The lust for war, the desire for profits, saw the Athenians lose sight of the ideals that were their great gift to us, ideals that should be our legacy to others. We live on images and slogans that perpetuate fantasies about our own invulnerability, our own might, our own goodness, and these illusions blind us. We cannot see ourselves as others see us. We had fed the heart on fantasies, William Butler Yeats wrote, the heart's grown brutal from the fair. It is 1967 in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. We have become Israel. Our empire is expanded, and in this we have become pariahs, propelled forward not by logic or compassion or understanding, but by fear. We have built an alliance against terror with Israel and Russia, Two nations who do not shrink from gratuitous and senseless killing in the Israeli-occupied territories and Chechnya. And those who are not with us, and few are with us now, we ridicule and belittle and condemn. We have become the company we keep. Much of the world, certainly the Muslim world, one-fifth of the world's population, most of whom, I remind you, are not Arab, see us through the prism of Iraq, Palestine, and Chechnya. And this prism is one that is igniting the dispossessed and deteriorating by the hour our security and safety. The attacks on the World Trade Center illustrate that those who oppose us, rather than coming from another moral universe, have been schooled well in modern warfare. The dramatic explosions, the fireballs, the victims plummeting to their deaths, the collapse of the towers in Manhattan were straight out of Hollywood. Where else but from the industrialized world did the suicide bombers learn that huge explosions and death above a city skyline are a peculiar and effective form of communication? They have mastered the language we taught them. They understand that the use of indiscriminate violence against innocents is a way to make a statement, and we leave the same calling cards. We delivered such incendiary messages in Vietnam, Serbia, Afghanistan, and Iraq. It was Secretary of Defense Robert McNamara who, in the summer of 1965, defined the bombing raids that would kill hundreds of thousands of civilians north of Saigon as a means of communication to the communist regime in Hanoi. I have spent most of my adult life in war. I began 2 decades ago covering wars in Central America, the Middle East, where I spent 5 years, then the Middle East, where I spent 7, and the Balkans, where I covered the wars in Bosnia and Kosovo. My life has been marred, let me say deformed, by the organized industrial violence that year after year was an intimate part of my existence. I have watched young men bleed to death on lonely Central American dirt roads and cobblestone squares in Sarajevo. I have looked into the eyes of mothers keening over the lifeless and mutilated bodies of their children. I have stood in warehouses with rows of corpses, including children, and breathed death into my lungs. I carry within me the ghosts of those I worked with, my comrades, now gone. After our defeat in Vietnam, we became a better nation. We were humbled, even humiliated. We asked questions about ourselves we had not asked before. We were forced to see ourselves as others saw us, and this sight was not an attractive one. We were forced to confront our own capacity for atrocity, for evil, and in this we understood not only war, but ourselves. But the seduction of war is insidious. It appears to be a way to eradicate our enemies, to banish from the world of the living those who would do us harm, and at a time when we are afraid, it gives us a false sense of power and security. The good name of war was carefully resurrected after Vietnam. It began under President Reagan in Grenada and Panama and culminated in the Persian Gulf War. We were led to believe, in the same way the doomed empires of the late 19th century believed, that our technology could make us invulnerable, a lie sadly unmasked as I speak tonight in the streets of Baghdad. War is the pornography of violence. It has a dark beauty filled with the monstrous and the grotesque. The Bible calls it the lust of the eye and warns believers against it. War gives us a distorted sense of self. It gives us meaning. It creates a feeling of comradeship that obliterates our alienation and makes us feel, for perhaps the first time in our lives, that we belong. War allows us to rise above our small stations in life. We find nobility in the cause. feelings of selflessness, even bliss. Once in a conflict, the shallowness of much of our lives becomes apparent, the fruitless search to find fulfillment in the acquisition of things and wealth and power is laid bare. The trivia that dominates our airwaves is exposed as empty chatter. War allows us to engage in lusts and passions we keep hidden in the deepest, most private interiors of our fantasy life. It allows us to destroy not only things, but human beings. In that moment of wholesale destruction, we wield the power of the divine, the power to revoke another person's charter to live on this earth. The frenzy of this destruction, and when unit discipline breaks down, or there was no unit discipline to begin with, frenzy is the right word, sees armed bands crazed by the poisonous elixir our power to bring about the obliteration of others delivers. All things, including human beings, become objects, objects to either gratify or destroy or both. Almost no one is immune. The contagion of the crowd sees to that. Force, Simon Weil writes, is as pitiless to the man who possesses it or thinks he does as it is to its victims. The second it crushes, the first it intoxicates. And those who have the least meaning in their lives, the impoverished Palestinian refugees in Gaza, the disenfranchised North African immigrants in France, even the legions of youth, in the splendid indolence and safety of the industrialized world, are all susceptible to war's appeal. I do not miss war, but I miss what it brought. I could never say I was happy in the fighting in El Salvador or Bosnia or Kosovo, but I had a sense of purpose. This is a quality war shares with love, for we are also able to choose fealty and self-sacrifice over security for those we love. This is why war, at its inception, always looks and feels like love, the chief emotion war destroys. The ancient Greeks understood the perverse attraction between love and death in wartime. When Achilles killed Penthesilea, the queen of the Amazons, in the Trojan War, he fell in love with her as she expired on the battlefield. He murdered love, and once he murdered love, he was doomed. He courted death. Aphrodite, the goddess of love, had an illicit affair with Ares, the god of war, hated by the other gods, with the exception of the god of the underworld, to whom he steadily brought new souls. We feel in wartime comradeship. We confuse this with friendship, with love. There are those who will insist that the comradeship of war is love, the ecstatic glow that makes us in war feel as one people, one entity is real. But this is part of war's intoxication. Think back on the days after the attacks of 9/11. Suddenly we no longer felt alone. We connected with strangers, even with people we did not like. We felt that we belonged, that we were somehow wrapped in the embrace of the nation, the community. In short, we no longer felt alienated. As this feeling dissipated in the weeks after the attack, there was a nostalgia for its warm glow. And wartime always brings with it this comradeship, which is the opposite of friendship. Friends, as J. Glenn Gray points out in his book, The Warrior's Reflections on Men in Battle, are predetermined. Friendship takes place between men and women who possess an intellectual and emotional affinity for each other. And many of us will admit that we never really had a friend, and even the most fortunate of us have very few. But comradeship, that ecstatic bliss that comes with belonging to the crowd in wartime, is within our reach. We can all have comrades. The danger, the external threat that comes when we face an enemy does not create friendship. It creates comradeship. And those in wartime are deceived about what they are undergoing. This is why once the war ends, these comrades again become strangers to us. This is why after war, we fall into despair. In friendship, there is a deepening of our sense of self. We become, through the friend, more aware of who we are and what we are about. We find ourselves in the eyes of the friend. Friends probe and question and challenge us to make each more complete. They draw the secrets out of us and know our inner core of being. For we reach and change others, and we are changed. When we plunge to the depths of our inner life, the depths that expose our insecurities, our incompleteness, those depths that often lie beyond articulation. In comradeship, the kind that comes to us in patriotic fervor, there is a suppression of self-awareness, self-knowledge, self-possession. Comrades lose their identities in wartime for the collective rush of a common cause, a common purpose. They are like erotic lovers. In comradeship, life becomes ecstatic and corporate, as opposed to friendship, where life is singular and individual. In comradeship, Gray reminds us, there are no demands on the self. This is part of its appeal, one of the reasons we miss it and seek to recreate it. Comradeship allows us to escape the demands on the self that is part of friendship. And this is why once the war is over, these feelings are extinguished. Sebastian Hoffner, who was a lawyer in Nazi Germany, wrote of this comradeship in his book Define Hitler. He noted that comradeship destroys the sense of responsibility for oneself, be it civilian or, worse still, the religious sense. Comradeship always sets the cultural tone at the lowest possible level, accessible to everyone, he wrote. It cannot tolerate discussion. In the chemical solution of comradeship, discussion immediately takes on the color of whining and grumbling. It becomes a mortal sin. Comradeship admits no thoughts, just mass feelings of the most primitive sort. These, on the other hand, are inescapable. To try and evade them is to put oneself beyond the pale. In wartime, when we feel threatened, we no longer face death alone, but as a group, and this makes death easier to bear. We ennoble self-sacrifice for the other, for the comrade. In short, we begin to worship death. And this is what the God of war demands from us. Think finally of what it means to die for a friend. It is deliberate and painful. There is no ecstasy. For friends, dying is hard and bitter. The dialogue they have and cherish will perhaps never be recreated. Friends do not, the way comrades do, love death and sacrifice. To friends, the prospect of death is frightening. And this is why friendship, or let me say love, is the most potent enemy of war. The reports from Iraq give us a war that has a coherency and logic it never has in battle. We taste a bit of war's exhilaration in the brief images, but are safe. And war from Iraq is fed to us with manufactured heroes, feel-good stories about our own, and an enemy that is always painted as barbaric and uncivilized. We can thrill in the perversity of war, even as we watch films or read books that are meant to denounce war. It is almost impossible to produce anti-war films or books or documentaries that also present images of battle. It is like trying to condemn pornography while showing erotic love scenes. The prurient fascination with violent death always overpowers the message. Vietnam War films are all pro-war. Anthony Swofford wrote in Jarhead his memoir of the First Persian Gulf War. No matter what the supposed message, what Kubrick or Coppola or Stone intended, Mr. and Mrs. Johnson in Omaha or San Francisco or Manhattan will watch the films and weep and decide once and for all that war is inhumane and terrible, They will tell their friends at church and their family this, but Corporal Johnson at Camp Pendleton and Sergeant Johnson at Travis Air Force Base and Seaman Johnson at Coronado Naval Station and Specialist Four Johnson at Fort Bragg and Lance Corporal Swafford at 29 Palms Marine Corps Base watch the same films and are excited by them. Because the magic brutality of the films celebrate the terrible and despicable beauty of their fighting skills. Fight, rape, war, pillage, burn. Filmic images of death and carnage are pornographic for the military man. It doesn't matter how many Mr. and Mrs. Johnsons are anti-war, the actual killers who know how to use the weapons are not. War is part of the modern industrial landscape. Indeed, its tools are often the cutting edge of technology. By World War I, we had created ways in which thousands of people who never saw their attackers could die in an instant. And weapons that carry out this impersonal mass slaughter are beautiful. They are crafted, sleek, and harbor within them awesome power. The machines of war, the planes, the tanks, the heavy machine guns, the huge hulking howitzers, and the helicopters are pieces of art. I have seen them at work. They are angels of death streaking through the sky. I was with a unit of guerrillas in El Salvador when some Huey helicopters raced in over a lake to hunt us down. We hid in the ruins of an abandoned village, darting from wall to wall, standing with our backs to the shattered bricks so our hunters could not see us as they passed low overhead. As I looked up at these machines that were trying to kill me, I found them seductive. Once in a conflict, once we live in the midst of fighting, we are moved from the abstract to the real, from the mythic to the sensory. No soldier or marine, after a few seconds of combat, believes in the myth of war anymore, and this is why wounded Marines jeered John Wayne when he visited them in a hospital in World War II. When this move takes place, we have nothing to do with a world not at war. The world, when we return to it, is viewed from the end of a very long tunnel. There they still believe. There they do not understand. We feel different, wiser, greater, and this experience is so overpowering that if we can control our fear, we go back to seek it out again. War is addictive. Indeed, it is the most potent narcotic invented by humankind. The first time I was in an ambush was in the Salvadoran town of Suchitoto. It was a dreary peasant outpost made up of stucco and mud and wattle huts off the main road. The town was surrounded by the Farabundo Martí, National Liberation Front rebels, who when I arrived in El Salvador were winning the war. The government forces kept a small garrison in the town, although its relief columns were frequently ambushed as they ambled down the small strip of asphalt surrounded by high grass. It was one of the most dangerous spots in the country. The rebels launched an attack to take the town. A convoy of reporters in cars marked with TV in masking tape on the windshields hightailed it to the small bridge that led to the lonely stretch of road into Suchitoto. Then we moved slowly down the road, the odd round fired ahead or behind us. We made it to the edge of town where we ran into rebel units now accustomed to the follies of the press. On foot, we moved through the deserted streets. The firing from the garrison became louder as we weaved our way with rebel units to the siege that had been set up. Then as I rounded a corner, several full bursts of automatic fire rent the air. Bullets hit the mud wall behind me. We dove into the dirt. Rebels began to fire noisy rounds from their M16 assault rifles. The scent of cordite filled the air. Rebels around me were wounded, crying out in pain. One died yelling in a sad cadence for his mother. The firefight seemed to go on for an eternity. I cannot say how long I lay there. It could have been a few minutes. It could have been an hour. Here was war, real war, sensory war, not the war of the movies and novels I had consumed in my youth. It was horrifying, confusing, numbing, and nothing like the myth I had been peddled. I realized at once that it controlled me. I would never control it. In a lull, I made a dash across an empty square to find shelter behind a house. My heart was racing. Adrenaline cursed through my bloodstream. I was safe. I made it back to the capital, and like most war correspondents, soon considered the experience a great cosmic joke. I drank away the fear in a seedy bar in downtown San Salvador that night. Most people, after such an experience, would learn to stay away. I was hooked. Drawn into the world of war, it becomes hard to escape. It perverts and destroys you. It pushes you closer and closer to your own annihilation, spiritual, emotional, and finally physical. It destroys the continuity of life, tearing apart all systems, economic, social, environmental, and political, all that makes life possible, all that sustains human beings. I covered the war in El Salvador from 1983 to 1988. By the end, I had a nervous twitch in my face. I was evacuated 3 times by the U.S. Embassy because of tips that the death squads planned to kill me. Yet each time I came back, I accepted with a grim fatalism that I would be killed in El Salvador. I could not articulate why I accepted my own destruction and cannot now. There came to be a part of me, maybe it is a part of all of us, which decided I would rather die like this than go back to the dull routine. During the war in El Salvador, I worked with a photographer who had a slew of close calls and then called it quits. He moved to Miami for one of the news weeklies, but life in Florida was flat, dull, uninteresting. He could not adjust and came back. From the moment he stepped off the plane, it was clear he had returned to die. And just as there are some soldiers or war correspondents who seem to us immortal and whose loss comes as a sobering reminder that death has no favorites, there are also those in war who are locked in a grim embrace with death from which they cannot escape. He was frightening to behold, a walking corpse. He was shot through the back in a firefight and died in less than a minute. Sigmund Freud divided the forces in human nature between the Eros instinct, the impulse within us that propels us to become close to others, to preserve and conserve, and the Thanatos, or death instinct, the impulse that works towards the annihilation of all living things, including ourselves. For Freud, these forces were in eternal conflict. He was therefore pessimistic about ever eradicating war. All human history, he argued, in civilization and its discontents is a tug of war between these two instincts. Taste enough of war and you come to believe the Stoics were right. We will, in the end, all consume ourselves in a vast conflagration. There is a constant search in war to find new perversities, new forms of death when the initial flush fades, a rear guard and finally futile effort to ward off the boredom of routine death. And this is why we would drive into towns in Bosnia and find bodies crucified on the sides of barns or decapitated and mutilated. This is why those slain in combat are treated as trophies belonging to the killers, turned into grotesque pieces of performance art. I know soldiers that to this day carry in their wallets the identity cards of men they know they killed. They take them everywhere. They show them to you with the imploring look of a lost child. They will never understand. In war, We deform ourselves, our essence. We give up individual conscience, maybe even consciousness, for the contagion of the crowd, the rush of patriotism, the belief that we must stand together as a nation in moments of extremity, to make a moral choice, to defy war's enticement, can be self-destructive. Yet in the rise to power, we always become smaller. Power absorbs us, and once power is obtained, we are its pawn. As in Shakespeare's Richard III, the all-powerful prince who molded the world, we fall prey to the forces we thought we had harnessed. Love may not always triumph, but it keeps us human. It offers the only chance to escape from the contagion of war. Perhaps it is the only antidote, and there are times when remaining human is the only victory possible. When the mask of war slips away and the rot and corruption is uncovered, when it turns sour and rank, when the myth is exposed as a fraud, we feel soiled and spent. It is then that we sink into despair. In the Arab-Israeli 1973 war, almost a third of all Israeli casualties were due to psychiatric causes, and the war lasted only a few days. A World War II study determined that after 60 days of continuous combat, 98% of all surviving soldiers will have become psychiatric casualties. A common trait among the 2% who were able to endure sustained combat was a predisposition towards aggressive psychopathic personalities. Lieutenant Colonel David Grossman, in his book On Killing, notes, "It is not too far from the mark to observe that there is something about continuous, inescapable combat which will drive 98% of all men insane, and the other 2% were crazy when they got there." During the war in El Salvador, soldiers could serve in the army for 3 or 4 years or longer, virtually until they psychologically or physically collapsed. In garrison towns, commanders banned the sale of sedatives because of the abuse by troops. In this war, the emotionally maimed were common. I once interviewed a 19-year-old Salvadoran army sergeant who had spent 5 years fighting and suddenly lost his vision after his unit walked into a rebel ambush. The rebels killed 11 soldiers in the firefight, including his closest friend. A couple dozen soldiers were wounded. He was unable to see again until he was placed in the Army hospital. "I have these horrible headaches," he told me, sitting on the edge of his bed. "There is shrapnel in my head. I keep telling the doctors to take it out." But the doctors told me he had no head wounds. I saw other soldiers in other conflicts go deaf or stop speaking or simply shake without being able to stop. War is necrophilia, and this necrophilia is central to soldiering just as it is central to the makeup of suicide bombers and terrorists. It is hidden under platitudes about duty and comradeship. It waits, especially in moments when we seem to have little to live for and no hope, or in moments when the intoxication of war is at its pitch to be unleashed. When we spend long enough in war, it comes to us as a kind of release, a fatal and seductive embrace that can consummate the long flirtation with our own destruction. In Milovan Jilic's memoir, Wartime, about the partisan war in Yugoslavia, he wrote of the enticement death held for the combatants. He stood over the body of his comrade, the commander Sava Kovekovich, and found, "Dying did not seem terrible or unjust. This was the most extraordinary, the most exalted moment of my life. Death did not seem strange or undesirable. That I restrained myself from charging blindly into the fray and death was perhaps due to my sense of obligation to the troops or to some comrade's reminder concerning the tasks at hand. In my memory, I returned to those moments many times with the same feeling of intimacy with death and desire for it while I was in prison, especially during my first incarceration. War, ascendant, wipes out eros. It wipes out delicacy and tenderness. Its communal power seeks to render the individual obsolete, to hand all passions, all moral choice, all voice to the crowd. The most important part of the individual life, which cannot be subsumed in communal life, is love, Hofner wrote. So comradeship has its special weapons against love. Smut. Every evening in bed after the last patrol round, there was the ritual reciting of lewd songs and jokes. This is the hard and fast rule of male comradeship. And nothing is more mistaken than the widely held opinion that this is a safety valve for frustrated erotic or sexual feelings. These songs and jokes do not have an erotic, arousing effect. On the contrary, they make the act of love appear as unappetizing as possible. They treat it like digestion and defecation and make it an object of ridicule. The men who recited rude songs and used coarse words for female body parts were in effect denying that they had ever had tender feelings or had been in love, that they had ever made themselves attractive, behaved gently. When we see our addiction for what it is, when we understand ourselves and how war has perverted us, life becomes hard to bear. John Steele, a cameraman who spent years in war zones, had a nervous breakdown in a crowded Heathrow airport after returning from Sarajevo. He understood the reality of his work, a reality that stripped away the self-righteous, high-octane gloss. "I came back from Sarajevo," he said. "We were in a place called Sniper's Alley, and I filmed a girl there who had been hit in the neck by a sniper's bullet. I filmed her in the ambulance, and only after she was dead, I suddenly understood that the last thing she had seen was the reflection of the lens of the camera I was holding in front of her. This wiped me out. I grabbed the camera and started running down Sniper's Alley, filming at knee level Bosnians running from place to place." A year after the war in Sarajevo, I sat with Bosnian friends who had suffered horribly. A young woman, Liliana, had lost her father, a Serb, who refused to join the besieging Serb forces around the city. She had been forced a few days earlier to identify his corpse. The body was lifted, the water running out of the sides of a rotting coffin from a small park for reburial in the central cemetery. She was emigrating for Australia soon, where she told me, "I will marry a man who has never heard of this war and raise children that will be told nothing about it, nothing about the country I am from." Liliana was young, but the war had exacted a toll. Her cheeks were hollow, her hair dry and brittle. Her teeth were decayed. Some had broken into jagged bits. She had no money for a dentist. She hoped to fix them in Australia. Yet, all she and her friends did that afternoon was lament the days when they lived in fear and hunger, emaciated, targeted by Serb gunners on the heights above. They did not wish back the suffering, and yet, they admitted, these may have been the fullest days of their lives. They looked at me in despair. I knew them when they were being pounded by hundreds of shells a day, had no water to bathe in or wash their clothes, when they huddled in unheated apartments as sniper bullets hit the walls outside. But what they expressed was real. It was the disillusionment with a sterile, futile, and empty present. Peace had again peeled back the void that the rush of war, of battle, had filled. Once again they were, as perhaps we all are, alone, no longer bound by a common struggle, no longer given the opportunity to be noble, heroic, no longer sure of what life was about or what it meant. The old comradeship, however false, had vanished with the last shot. Moreover, they had seen that all the sacrifice had been for naught. They had been, as we all are in war, betrayed. The corrupt old Communist Party bosses who became nationalists overnight and got them into the mess in the first place had grown rich off their suffering and were still in power. There was a 70% unemployment rate. They depended on handouts from the international community. They understood that their cause, once as fashionable in certain intellectual circles as they were themselves, lay forgotten. No longer did actors, politicians, and artists scramble to visit during the ceasefires, acts that were almost always ones of gross self-promotion. They knew the lie of war, the mockery of their idealism, and struggled with their shattered illusions. And yet, they wished it all back, and I did too. A year later, I received a Christmas card. It was signed, Liliana from Australia. It had no return address. I never heard from her again. But many of those I worked with as war correspondents during the past two decades did not escape. They could not break free from the dance with death. They wandered from conflict to conflict, seeking always one more hit. By then I was back in Gaza and found myself pinned down in another ambush. A young Palestinian 15 feet away was shot through the chest and killed. I had been lured back, but now felt none of the old rush, just fear. It was time to break free, to let go, to accept that none of this would or could or should return. I knew it was over. I was lucky to get out alive. Kurt Schork, brilliant, courageous, driven, could not let go. He died in an ambush in Sierra Leone, along with another friend, Miguel Gil Moreno. His entrapment, his embrace of thanatos, of the death instinct, was never mentioned in the sterile and antiseptic memorial service staged for him in Washington. Everyone tiptoed around it. But for those of us who knew him, we understood that he had been consumed. I had worked with Kurt for 10 years, starting in northern Iraq. Literate, funny, seems the brave are often funny. He and I passed books back and forth in our struggle to make sense of the madness around us. His loss is a hole that will never be filled. His ashes were placed in the Lions Cemetery in Sarajevo for the victims of the war. I flew to Sarajevo and met the British documentary filmmaker Dan Reed. It was an overcast November day. We stood over the grave and downed a pint of whiskey. Dan lit a candle. I recited a poem the Roman lyric poet Catullus had written to honor his dead brother. By strangers' coasts and waters, many days at sea, I come here for the rites of your unworlding, bringing for you the dead, these last gifts of the living, and my words, vain sounds for the man of dust. Alas, my brother, you have been taken from me. You have been taken from me, and by cold chance turned to shadow and my pain. Here are the foods of the old ceremony, appointed long ago for the starvelings under the earth. Take them. Your brother's tears have made them wet, and take into eternity my hail and my farewell. It was there, among 4,000 war dead, that Kurt belonged. He died because he could not free himself from war. He was trying to replicate what he had found in Sarajevo, but he could not. War could never be new again. Kurt had been in East Timor and Chechnya. Sierra Leone, I was sure, meant nothing to him. Kurt and Miguel could not let go. They would be the first to admit it. Spend long enough at war, and you cannot fit in anywhere else. It finally kills you. It is not a new story. It starts out like love, but it is death. War is the beautiful young nymph in the fairy tale that, when kissed, exhales the vapors of the underworld. The ancient Greeks had a word for such a fate, ek pyrosis. It means to be consumed by a ball of fire, and they used it to describe heroes. Thank you.
That concludes the reading for this event. Next up is the conversation.
I think you got a very different reception here than you did in Rockford, Illinois. And I was wondering, as we focus on dissent in America and what you can say and what you can't say, if you could share that experience with us, giving the commencement address at a place that is ironically most known because Jane Addams went to that school and she herself was a pacifist.
Unfortunately for me, that's all I knew about the school. So I thought I was addressing socialist pacifists. This was right after President Bush had landed on the aircraft carrier and a couple days before and announced mission accomplished. And the criticism of the war unleashed exactly the kinds of passions that I write about in War is a Force That Gives Us Meaning that I spoke about tonight. It was not only an angry crowd that responded to this criticism of our invasion and coming occupation and our self-glorification, which is I think always an element of nationalism or blind patriotism. But I was challenging that emotional state of comradeship so that as I spoke, not only was I booed and heckled and I had my microphone cut a couple times, but people stood and began singing God Bless America, and I could see in the front row that they were weeping. And these passions are real. And to me, frightening. I've seen them, this collective euphoria of the crowd in other places, in squares in the Plaza de Mayo in Argentina or Belgrade. And tackling those, challenging that emotional state, which I think for many people is very much about overcoming alienation and loneliness, is deeply disturbing. Towards the end of the talk, which had to be abbreviated, two or three young men from the crowd tried to climb up on the podium and to attack me, and the security were pushing them off. But there's no question that if they had reached me, several and hit me or pushed me down or whatever their plan was, the mood of the crowd was such that several hundred people would have cheered. And I think that those passions, and they're not peculiar to American society. I've seen that disease of nationalism around the world, but it is a disease. And, of course, it is precisely that disease which gripped the country after 9/11 and really, I think in many ways, contributed to the mess that we're in now.
What made you decide to give the speech to the end?
Well, I didn't make it to the end. I cut it short. And I was taken out in the, before they got their diplomas. I was literally taken off the podium in the middle of the ceremony. They just It was my first and last commencement address.
You told the story in Losing Moses on the Freeway, and you share the headline the next day in the Rockford Register Star. Speaker disrupts RC graduation.
Right.
You. Now, you were writing for the New York Times at the time.
Yes.
What was their response to your anti-war address?
Well, what happened was the cable news shows had a feeding frenzy, and Rush Limbaugh and company, and I being in the business was not going to. I went on your program, and that was pretty much it. Because I didn't want to keep throwing them little pieces of red meat day in and day out. No matter what I said, I didn't want to sustain the story, which had an afterlife of about 4 days as it was. The paper called me in and delivered a formal written reprimand because I had impugned the impartiality of the New York Times and told me that I was no longer allowed to speak about the war, which I had no intention of abiding by that demand, of course. I just want to say something about that because Amy's seen it in the book and Losing Moses, but it was actually quite a moving moment for me because, and I'm not going to pretend that I wasn't really nervous and really scared. I mean, I'd been 15 years there. I knew this was the end. Nobody likes to lose their job. But I grew up, my dad was a Presbyterian minister, a veteran of World War II, and I grew up in a small farming town in upstate New York. And he was very involved in the civil rights movement, which many people forget in the early 1960s, especially in these small rural white enclaves. Martin Luther King was one of the most hated men in America. And so as a young boy of 8 or 9, I felt the sting of people attacking my father, who then went on to oppose the Vietnam War. I remember when I was about 11 or 12, he said that if the war was still continuing, he would go to prison with me. And I still have this vision of sitting in a jail cell for 2 years with my father. But he died in 1995, but the last part of his life, he was working in the gay rights movement. And when I went to college at Colgate University, there was no gay and lesbian organization, and my father thought this was an abomination. And he actually brought the gay speakers to speak at my university. And I would sit around small groups like that. And I remember when I would go into the dining hall, what finally happened is that my father came and took me out to lunch one day and said that because the students didn't want to come out of the closet, they couldn't found their own organization. And so I had to found it. So I founded the gay and lesbian organization at Colgate. And when I would go into the dining hall, the guy would take my card and check it off for breakfast, lunch, or dinner, hand it back, and go, faggot. So I made it my personal mission, my undergraduate mission, to seduce his girlfriend. As I sat in the New York Times at that moment, I knew I had a choice. I could pay fealty to my career and to this institution and be muzzled, or I could betray my father. And I wasn't going to betray my father.
So that was it?
That was pretty much it. I was sent off into, at the New York Times, it operates like the old Soviet Union. Suddenly you find yourself no longer in Moscow, but a minor party chief in Tajikistan, sort of like that. And nobody tells you, you just appear there.
You did the Public Lives column after being a war correspondent for the years that you were, but you used that column.
Well, that got me in even more trouble,
Because perhaps there's nothing more powerful. You can say a million people died somewhere, and no one will blink an eye. But you tell us one person's name, and everyone pays attention, and that's Public Lives, if used in the way you were trying to use it.
Yeah, they didn't. That wasn't how they envisioned the column. That's how I used it. But.
the woman who was the star of the little TV screens and taxis that failed in New York?
Well, that's what they, because they I got called, well, then, of course, I got sent off to do that, and I kept writing about people organizing, who was the great woman who organized the, you know, the woman who organized the protest, got 100,000 people in the streets in New York. Anyway, I did her, and I did also, you know, the Gold Star mother, a woman who lost her son in Iraq. And
Leslie Kagan.
Leslie Kagan, she's great. And so they called me in, I mean, and said that I was no longer allowed to pick people for the columns, and they sent me off to write about a sort of young 20-something model who, when I got her resume, it said she was a natural blonde on the resume, who was doing the infomercials on for the TV screens they tried to put in the backs of New York taxi cabs. So I think the lead of that story, because I couldn't let go, was I'm going to butcher it, but it was something like, you know, find one of the few places left in New York where you can have an intelligent conversation, and sure enough, someone's going to come along and ruin it.
It was hard to ever really see her face as it was, because so many of these screens had been broken in
people,
the taxi.
That's right.
People were so angered by
it. It didn't work out real well for them.
But Chris, I was wondering if you could share with us a cautionary tale. This piece just came out in Mother Jones, I'm sure you know, that talks about after 9/11, a piece that you did with a source, Ahmed Chalabi. And from the vantage point that you have, and with all the wisdom and the years that you bring to coverage, can you talk about how it happens from the inside? You knew Ahmed Chalabi for years. Tell us, walk us through this and how you ended up with this piece that ended up not being true.
Yeah. Well, Chalabi, I mean, I'd been in the Middle East for 7 years, and Chalabi had been, after the first Persian Gulf War, a huge player. He'd actually moved up into northern Iraq and set up a base of operations. The CIA was funneling, I believe, about $25 million, primarily through Chalabi, to try and orchestrate a Sunni military coup to replace Saddam with another thug, but a thug who would be friendly to the United States. This was the policy. It failed. And Chalabi was leaking all sorts of stories to reporters about, you know, attempted coups and somebody, some colonel being assassinated because he tried to overthrow Saddam and these kinds of stuff. And he developed a reputation over several months of this of being very unreliable and creating stories that really had no factual basis. Many of which, I mean, he ran a clever operation. I mean, he was certainly helped by the CIA. And so we who had dealt with Chalabi were always extremely wary of him. But, you know, reporters like scoops and reporters like front page stories, and he was willing to hand reporters very sexy stuff that people like Louis Libby and others in Washington would confirm. So you'd get a fictitious story from Chalabi, and it would be confirmed in Washington. And this is, of course, typified most of the coverage, the pre-war. It's how these lies were disseminated in the New York Times, not just the New York Times, I think in most mainstream news organizations. And I was in Paris covering Al-Qaeda with the French. I covered all of Europe except Germany and North Africa, so I traveled a lot. But I worked a lot with French intelligence and stayed very clear of Chalabi. The two contacts were Judy Miller, of course, and Lowell Bergman. And they were the two people who worked with Chalabi. Lowell had cut, I haven't read this story, but this is the scenario. Lowell had worked for Frontline and was filming documentaries very much based on Chalabi's quote-unquote informers who would have shadowy faces and this kind of stuff. And for some reason, Lowell could not make it to Beirut to interview somebody that Chalabi had coughed up. And so I was called from Paris and sent to Beirut and appeared briefly in the, I've never actually watched it, but I guess for a minute or two, in the documentary and wrote the story out. This was a story that turned out not to be, I haven't gone and investigated it, but I think we can pretty safely say it was probably another one of Chalabi's fictions. And it was a story about training at a place called Salmon Pack. The problem with investigative journalism, I was on the investigative unit of the Times, is that it's very rare that an investigative reporter works alone. You know, if you see a story, even if it has one byline, there's usually many reporters that not only have contributed reporting, but oftentimes writing whole sections of it. And this is something that's very common. It has been done for me. I did it for other people. I mean, for instance, stories would come out, an intelligence piece would come out of Washington, and they would want, you know, I would be interviewing the head of Spanish intelligence, and I would write up that interview, and then that would get sent to Washington and incorporated into the text. So it was not at all suspect that I would go and do this, although it was Lowell's piece, and unfortunately contribute in that moment to what I think we can safely say was misinformation.
I guess the Iraqi general who alleged that terrorists were training in Iraq to fly planes into buildings, Jamal al-Ghareri, the man that you interviewed, turns out he may well not have been this general, that he was an imposter.
I don't think they found him. But, given Chalabi's track record, and Chalabi, you know, even in that brief moment that I was with him, had all sorts of stories he was willing to sell, but he was so dirty. And fortunately for me, Judy was, so proprietary over her control of Charlie that I got to go back to Paris and hang out with the French who, it turns out, were right.
Why didn't the Times stop it? I mean, it's one thing to have one story.
Right.
It's one to have two. But for this endless drumbeat before the invasion that really paved the way for that war, for, as Noam Chomsky says, manufacturing consent for war, terrifying the population.
Yeah, that's what they did. I think because when you work in a paper like the Times, you can work essentially as a stenographer for people in power. That's certainly what White House correspondents do. It's what State Department correspondents do. And that is seen as an important part of the enterprise. I mean, a paper like the New York Times very much wants to feel that they're a player, that they're on the inside, that they are getting information that other people aren't getting. And they're very quickly seduced by that, especially if they feel that it's an exclusive. I think a lot of it had to do with the personality of the reporters involved. Because those reporters were true believers, they were not listening to Bardet and others who had credible information and certainly expertise. Those people virtually didn't have a voice within the paper.
Mohammed al-Bardet, the head of the International Atomic Energy Agency.
So, I mean, as a foreign correspondent, you do battle with Washington, but you also do battle with your own Washington bureau, because being a reporter in Washington means doing lunch. It means catering to sources who have, you know, when they give you information, have a vested interest in spinning it in a certain way. So this is a long story. I mean, going back to Halberstam in Vietnam, but I'd be writing one thing out of Bosnia, and the Washington spin by Sandy Berger or someone else who was head of NSC would be different, and you'd be running both stories. That's a long failing within mainstream journalism. But it has been a terrible failing because, of course, what it did is, in the long run, the product that we have to sell as journalists, if you look at it that way, is credibility. And whatever heat news organizations would have taken during the war for standing up and presenting information that conflicted with that was being doled out by the administration, that many people wanted to hear, of course, once it turned out that they were right, their credibility would have been enhanced. In fact, they not only played into the hands of the Bush administration in terms of manipulation, but also in terms of damaging their own credibility and weakening themselves as an institution.
And talking about reporters lunching at home in Washington, in Iraq, being targeted, I mean, more journalists have died in Iraq right now than we have ever seen in a conflict. The last young woman, 30 years old, Atwar Bajat, who had worked for Al Jazeera, then Al Arabiya, who was Sunni Shia herself in Iraqi, wore a necklace of the map of Iraq, just killed a few days ago in Samarra. And the Al Jazeera reporters, a number of them, U.S. bombing of the Baghdad office in Afghanistan as well, Mazen Dana, the Palestinian reporter, top cameraman for Reuters, didn't die in the occupied territories, but died filming outside Abu Ghraib when the military said, said they engaged a cameraman. What about this? Do you think that reporters are being targeted? The Palestine Hotel, of course, being attacked by the U.S. military.
Well, I can speak from personal experience in Israel where reporters were clearly targeted.
By?
Israelis. I mean, I watched Israeli soldiers in places like Gaza turn like this, mostly cameramen because it's the images they hate, and shoot cameramen in the legs. From everything that I can see, I mean, I have not been covering this conflict, it does appear that reporters have been targeted. I mean, you know, hitting the Palestine Hotel, the moments of, especially, you know, if you're in the midst of a firefight or, you know, there's a riot or there's unrest, I mean, the adrenaline rush, the anger, the rage, you know, when you go into with soldiers who are in the midst of combat, I mean, their eyes are sort of, you know, completely, it's as if they're in a trance. I mean, there's a kind of, they mutter gibberish. I mean, it's that moment of connection, of violence, is one where you stop thinking and you just react. And the other important thing to remember about being in a situation of combat is that, you know, it's you or them. A lot of times they just don't ask questions what's around them. I mean, especially in Iraq where they're just sort of sweeping everything with fire. This is what's happened to, you know, many, many Iraqi families who pulled up in cars too close to roadblocks. They just don't exist anymore. But it does appear to me that there have just been too many incidents to say that they're all accidental. And, of course, the head of CNN got in huge trouble for saying this.
Okay, Eason Jordan.
Yeah.
Your assessment of the whole embedding process, Victoria Clark, the former spokesperson, now a CNN consultant, called it a spectacular success. You were embedded in the first Gulf War, is that right?
No,
were you with Marines?
No, I was, but I was a unilateral.
What does it mean to be unilateral with the Marines?
It means being a journalist. It means you're not part of the pool system. No, I shaved off all my hair. I had a uniform. When I pulled up to the roadblocks, the MPs would call me sir. And I lived out in the desert, and I was on a list that drawn up by our vice president at the time, the defense secretary, Cheney, for 15 journalists they wanted to expel. But they couldn't find me because I didn't hang out with the other journalists. So no, I was not embedded. I never embedded. It was called the pool system in the first Gulf War. It was the precursor to the embed system. They saw how well it worked. Only 160 reporters were pooled out of like about 1,000. So what would happen is most of the reporters were sitting back in hotels having their, you know, the pool copy faxed back to them and then rewriting it for their papers, or the pool footage coming back and sending it off to their news organization.
So this is what pool means? You sit by the pool and...
What was so disturbing for me about that whole system is that it was administered and run by reporters. It could not have... wasn't run by the military. And that's because most reporters in a war don't really want to get out. They don't tell that to their bosses. But, you know, in the first Persian Gulf War, the Iraqis, their artillery shells had a range of 70 kilometers. We knew they had biological and chemical agents. So 90-something% of all reporters were not going to be within that 70-kilometer range, period. So They were and what most news organizations did was fly the reporters from Washington over to Saudi Arabia. And what did they do when they landed in Saudi Arabia? They got down on their knees and they begged for briefings. They begged for the dog and pony shows that Schwarzkopf was running, and they wanted to recreate what they did in Washington. They didn't want to go anywhere near the front. And that's true in most wars.
So what happened to you and the Saudi regime?
Well, I had constant problems. I mean, I had my credentials taken away from me, which really didn't matter because I didn't use them. And I worked with the Marine Corps because the Army ran the press system, so there were almost no pool reporters with the Marines. And so the Marines, in their wisdom, figured out that this was just another huge conspiracy by the U.S. Army against the Marine Corps. And so when I got with 1st Battalion, 1st Marines, and I also had a very enlightened battalion commander. I stayed with them, and then anytime like visiting officers would come over, I would have to like stand in the background, and he said, "Don't worry, I'll tell him you're a reservist." And so that's how I covered the war. I mean, I had my own vehicle. I drove into Kuwait I drove my Jeep, my Toyota Jeep, through the lines into Kuwait until we got north of Baghdad. And you asked about the Saudi military police. That was for the Battle of Hafji when the Iraqis made a lunge into northern Saudi Arabia and took the Saudi border town of Hafji. And the Saudi defenders like got in all their air-conditioned cars and on the fire trucks and fled as fast as they could. So the Iraqis got the town virtually without a shot, and then the Marines I was with got sent in to clean it out. So I went in with them while Schwarzkopf was giving these weepy press conferences about the Saudis bleeding on their soil of their homeland to fight back the Iraqis. Of course, there wasn't a Saudi in the town. And when I and others got out and reported it, when I got out, I was with two French photographers, and when I got out, we got beaten up by Saudi military police. And when we reported it, then they had to say that it was a combined operation, you know, that there were Marines and so on.
You also were captured by the Iraqi.
That was after the war, because after I got into Kuwait City, then there was a Shiite uprising in Basra, so I went to Basra until I was captured and taken prisoner by the Iraqi Republican Guard. So I was embedded, but with the Iraqi Republican Guard.
And how long were you held?
About 8 or 9 days.
And what did you think was going to happen?
Well, for the first 30 minutes, I thought I was going to get shot through the head. I mean, I got shoved in the back of my Jeep. They stole my Jeep, but they shoved me in the back seat, put a barrel of an AK-47 in my head, drove off the tarmac into the desert, so I assumed I was going to be rolled out the door and killed. But they took me to their colonel, who had their command post out in the desert, and I speak Arabic, which I'm sure saved my life and saved the life of Neil Conan from National Public Radio, who was with me. And I was, of course, terrified. But I had this wonderful Palestinian professor who taught me Arabic. And one of the techniques was to memorize every corny Arabic joke in existence. The equivalent of Arabic knock-knock jokes. And I could rattle them off. So I didn't know what to do. So I started telling really stupid. And it just broke the tension, and everybody thought it was funny. So they didn't shoot us. They shoved us into a Mercedes-Benz with no windows with about 6 or 7 Iraqi soldiers. And we go, you know, racing at about 90 miles an hour through the streets of Basra that are in total flames. I mean, the city's like in the middle of an uprising. And these guys are just, you know, firing clips of AK-47s out the window. And they dump us in Basra University, which was the headquarters of the Iraqi Republican Guard, and speed off. And this colonel, we're lying on the ground, this colonel comes out and goes in accent English, "Welcome, welcome." Like that. And then we were all interrogated. And everybody's interrogation was the same. They'd take your passport and it must be an East German technique or something. They would say, "Oh, you don't look so old, and you look much younger," and then they would. It was long. I mean, it was a bad week because we were held in a. There was no food, and there was a lot of fighting. The first night, we were held in a in the university, and the Shiites made an attack, and they took the building we were in, and we had to flee to another one, and there was no electricity, and there was firing all night long. And then I got hooked up with a light armor battalion that was trying to punch through north to Baghdad, and about 60 miles north of Basra, we got ambushed, and there was 16 hours of a firefight, and so it was a long week.
As you look at the situation now, what do you think has to happen?
Well, you know, we're losing the war pretty badly. It's not a tenable situation. We have, at this point it may be too late, but I mean we have to figure out some kind of a phased withdrawal that gives the Iraqis at least the outside chance that their country will not be torn apart into a Yugoslavia-type civil war. We just may at this point be too far down the road to even prevent that. What I fear is that, you know, with this administration and many in the press just completely denying the reality, or certainly the severity of what's gone wrong, and how, in classical insurgent terms, this war has moved, you know, far faster than, for instance, the war that I covered in El Salvador. You have whole sections of the country, even parts of Baghdad, that are controlled by the insurgents. And there was a little item in the news the other day about how they're setting off IEDs and then ambushing the columns. In terms of, you know, defining an insurgency, that's a huge step, that they can hang, that they feel confident enough to hang around and actually engage the troops after the bombs go off. So what I fear is that, you know, we will keep living in this, feeding off of these illusions about staying the course and all the other rhetoric we get fed, and then out of sheer exhaustion just disappear, which is, in the invasion and occupation, was deeply irresponsible, but just turning our backs and cutting and running has become so. But I don't see anybody, at least in power, grappling with the reality of what's going on.
In the next few weeks, on the third anniversary of the invasion, there's a whole movement to say anti-war activists should become media activists and march from one institution to another, I mean, in New York, from the networks to the New York Times. What do you think would penetrate through to a place like your former employer, the New York Times, to cover movements like the anti-war movement as much as they cover, say, the comments of Henry Kissinger, but on a regular basis include them in the discourse and the front pages, and to challenge the administration in a very serious way, open the debate between the very narrow spectrum of the Republicans and the Democrats, which often, if they agree, then you get no spectrum in the paper.
Right. I think the only thing that would shake up the media organizations is if their advertisers marched on them. These organizations have become so commercial, and they pander so much. I mean, look at the New York Times. New York Times, you know, there are more and more stories about lifestyle. But whose lifestyle? It's so hard to keep that second house in the Hamptons. Gigantic sections of this country in the media are just virtually invisible. I mean, you saw it with Katrina. But, you know, that evolution for somebody who's been doing it as long as I have is deeply disturbing. We used to cover labor. We used to cover the inner city. We used to cover the school system. We used to cover all that. But, you know, there's a huge identity crisis, especially in big newspapers who don't, you know, have not adjusted well to the changing technology. And their response has been to become more cowardly, more insular, and try and pander to their economic and political elite because they want to retain the advertising revenues. That has become fundamental. What they're doing in the process is, of course, gutting and destroying their journalistic integrity so that in the end, they don't stand for anything and they don't say anything. And it's sad to watch, but it's a kind of willful suicide of American journalism. We have to hope. I mean, you're a great hope. We have to hope that And perhaps in some ways it's healthy that new entities arise. But I think we are seeing an era when what is classically defined as the mainstream press is dying.
I wanted to end with what you're doing today. You've talked about war as a crusade. Now you've come back home to this country and you're looking at other crusaders. Can you talk about the Christian right and what you're doing now?
I'm writing a book that will be out in the fall on the Christian right. And I am not willing, as somebody who grew up in the church and graduated from seminary, to give them any religious legitimacy at all. They are a mass political movement that have cannibalized the evangelical tradition. They are the most potent and frightening enemies of America's open society. And the title of the book will be American Fascists. The Christian Right in the War on America. And what I've done is tried to take apart their ideology, the cult of masculinity, the war on truth. I mean, what they've done is create a non-reality-based belief system for their masses, which is what all totalitarian movements do, and give people, just as I tried to do with War as a Force that Gives Us Meaning, give people another vocabulary to speak about a movement that I think is trying to destroy our country.
Do you think there is a strong enough movement to counter that?
No. I think the problem is that, tolerance is a virtue, but tolerance coupled with passivity is a vice. And there are moments when we cannot tolerate the intolerant, because not only will tolerance disappear, but not only will the belief in tolerance disappear, but the tolerant will disappear with them. And I think that that when you have people being indoctrinated, as millions of Americans are, within these closed information systems through Christian radio and Christian broadcasting, when they're fighting tooth and nail to defeat hate crimes legislation, because they know that at their core, what their ideology, their homophobia, their assault on women, their branding people like myself, who they would call a nominal Christian, as being driven by forces of Satan and worthy only of discipline. This is their language. That that at their core, what they preach is exclusion and intolerance and hatred. When you pick apart, the generic elements of their and people are not standing up to them. The response, if you look at even like Howard Dean and others, is or to quote Kerry, we have values too. Well, these people don't have values, and the fact is that what we're doing is legitimizing a movement that should not be legitimized, and in the process, delegitimizing ourselves. And I think that there has to be. I debated Tony Perkins on Diane Rehm's show after Justice Sunday, and I didn't ask him one question about Justice Sunday. All I asked him about is the Bible, because that is their house of sand. They have so perverted and distorted and misused the Bible to back a totalitarian creed. That they're deeply vulnerable. And I think their most potent critics, like Bill Moyers, are biblically literate, because they know that. So that the first question I asked Perkins was, how can you promote the teaching of creationism in schools when the writers of the book of Genesis thought the earth was flat? And there's no, it's endless. And I think that that unfortunately most of their critics, often their critics tend to be secular, and so they immediately cede them that religious legitimacy, which they hide behind. And if you don't cross that, they can take the criticism. When you cross that, then they get frightened.
And their relationship with the current White House, with President Bush?
Well, it's a marriage between rapacious corporate interests, an uneasy marriage, that know that the Christian right wants to dismantle the federal government, destroy the Department of Education and Housing and Urban Development and regulatory agencies, and so these people are the sort of foot soldiers or the grassroots to push through a frightening, essentially a destruction of the economic safeguards that have protected, at least used to protect, the working class in this country.
Do you have any hope after this latest investigation?
Well, I had a great theology professor who always told me that, for every intellectual or anybody who understood the world, faith was an embarrassment. I have faith that it's worth doing and it's worth fighting back. I think when you come out of situations as bleak as I did in, for instance, Bosnia, where just getting into a town where a massacre had taken place by Serb forces was so dangerous and so difficult, and then getting out and writing the story and getting it published and making it that much harder for them to wake up the next morning and say that they did it, that becomes a huge victory. It doesn't mean they won't go out the next day and do it again, but I think you have faith that it means something. And certainly I feel, coming out of the church, coming out of seminary, having watched closed systems and how they work and nationalist or totalitarian movements, whether it's Milosevic or Hamas or others, how they function has given me a kind of insight into the Christian right and a kind of responsibility to the best that I can explain it.
Chris Hedges, thank you very much.
Thank you.
I didn't read the Mother Jones piece yet. I hope they were nice to me.
You've been listening to a Lannan podcast. You can subscribe to our podcast at podcast.lannan.org. In addition, the Lannan Audio Archives present similar programs by national and international writers, poets, and social activists at www.lannan.org. Listen to hundreds of hours of recorded programs from the likes of Seamus Haney, Joy Harjo, Eduardo Galeano, Arundhati Roy, Jim Harrison, Edwige Dantica, and Noam Chomsky. New programs are added every month to both the podcast and the audio archives.